Chapter 93, Seemingly All Lost. After the iconoclasm followed an oppressive calm, as the stillness after a violent storm which has finally spent itself. But it was not a beneficial calm. The people held their breath and in anxious tension awaited the consequences for their country. What would the government do? The government? That was at its wits' end. They no longer knew what to do. A panic almost broke out in Brussels. The governess wanted to flee. The carriages stood all ready. Margaret of Parma wanted to flee to the strong fortress of Mons in Hainaut. There she would be safe. But the stadtholders, such as Orange, Egmont, and Horn, have strongly discouraged her from that flight and held her back. Only reluctantly the governess remained in Brussels because she feared that any moment in Brussels itself the people would be stirring. In her mind she already saw the churches destroyed, her palace plundered, and she herself a prisoner of the people filled with hatred. In her anguish, she agreed to a sort of religious peace. The placards were abolished, so that the persecution ceased. The Protestant preaching was permitted wherever that had taken place before. Also, in various places, some churches were ceded to the Reformed. People rejoiced because they hoped and expected that it would always remain that way. Finally, finally, an end would come to the shedding of blood. But they were mistaken, because very dark times would still come. Through the iconoclasm, the League of the Nobles, in which Protestants and Roman Catholics joined, was broken up. The Roman Catholic nobles were incensed and no longer would have anything to do with the entire movement. When the governess noticed that the riot did not spread any further, then her fears soon disappeared because she had feared that it would become a complete popular uprising. However, that did not happen. When the tidings of the iconoclasm reached Spain, Philip II became almost insane with rage. He swore, by the soul of his father, that he would get even with the Dutch people. All would be punished. The Protestants, because they had done it, and the Roman Catholics, because they had not checked it. In his soul lived only one thought: vengeance. That deed had to be avenged. The two Dutch nobles, Bergen and Montigny, who had traveled to Spain to speak with the king, could have better remained home. They never returned to their native country. They were treated as prisoners. Bergen died in Spain of homesickness, and at the command of Philip II, Montigny was murdered. The hypocrite had it made known in the Netherlands that Montigny had become ill, and in spite of careful nursing, he succumbed to his sickness. But that was a great lie. He was murdered. Later, that has become known from secret letters of the king. It was too bad that they ever traveled to Spain. Philip II thought it better that not his sister Margaret of Parma, the governess, would take care of the retaliation upon those Dutchmen. No, he had someone else for that, who according to him was better qualified. His sister would not tackle that case with sufficient vigor. She was only a woman, was she not? He would send the Duke of Alva with a strong army to the Netherlands. This duke had received the byname of the Iron Duke. He was just the man Philip II needed for this. Alva was not greatly honored with that commission, yet he accepted it. He would bring that people of Butter to terms. Granville, the former chairman of the Privy Council, who knew the Dutch better than Alva, said upon that in a casual way, "You better be careful that those people of Butter will not slip through your fingers." He was right, because he knew how the Dutch people were. In the meantime, conditions in the Netherlands were altogether changed. The governess, having recovered from her fright, took very strong measures. The persecutions raged again in all their violence. In his province, the Count of Egmont persecuted the Reformed with fire and sword. With unmerciful cruelty, he carried on against them. We usually think too well of Count Egmont. We consider him as a sort of a martyr, because a few years later, at the command of Alva, he was beheaded at Brussels. But we must never forget that his hands were stained with the blood of hundreds of God's children. He has been an insolent persecutor of the Church of the Lord. He has been excessively obedient to the commands of his king. Too obedient. The composer of the Netherlands Confession of Faith, the God-fearing Guido de Bray, together with another preacher, has also been put to death at that time. No, when we think of this, we really need not honor Count Egmont. Only the Prince of Orange kept himself punctually to the terms of the religious peace about which we just told you. In Antwerp, the Protestants received three churches in which they could hold their religious services. In Antwerp, no one was persecuted because of his faith. That was also promised, was it not? Yet, dark clouds gathered over the Protestants. As we already wrote, the League of the Nobles had gone to pieces. Also, the alliance of the merchants, who had offered 3 million florins to the king if he would stop the persecution, could not accomplish anything. The king had not paid any attention to that. Only the alliance of the consistories still existed. That alliance stood under the leadership of monarchs of St. Aldegonde. When the governess began to assemble troops to severely punish the rebels, then the allied consistories also began to recruit a small army. Soon there was an army of beggars, of 3,000 men together. They asked the Prince of Orange if he would assume the command. He refused. After that they asked Horn, but he did not dare to tackle that. Finally, Henry of Brederode became the commander. However, he was entirely incompetent for that. In the little town of Oosterweel, close to Antwerp, the army of beggars assembled. They hoped for support from Antwerp and Zeeland. Count Egmont immediately warned the governess. She did not delay for one moment. With the greatest speed, an army was sent after them. On the 13th of March, 1567, the army of beggars at Oosterweel was suddenly attacked, and within a few hours, totally defeated. The commander, Henry of Brederode, just happened to be away. Hundreds were cut down. Hundreds were driven into the Scheldt River and drowned miserably. 600 others fled into a building. That was set on fire by the troops of the governess, and all perished in the flames. Only a few escaped that slaughter. What a sad end that was to the army of beggars. And all that happened in the immediate vicinity of the powerful commercial city of Antwerp. Although thousands of citizens in Antwerp stood ready to assist them, The Prince of Orange had the gates closed. He saw no good in this, and wanted to spare the city against the vengeance of the governess. Whether that was the right thing to do, I do not know. Perhaps it would have turned out different if the Prince of Orange had immediately chosen the side of the Reformation. However that may be, it did not happen, and this meant the destruction of the army of beggars at Oosterweel. The South Netherlands city of Valenciennes, which had closed its gates to the troops of the governess, after a desperate defense, was captured by the troops of the governess and its inhabitants almost entirely massacred. Of every 6 inhabitants, 5 fell at the hands of murderers. We shall not mention the atrocities which have been committed by the Roman Catholic soldiers in that woeful city. They are too gruesome and cruel. It is better that we are silent about that. One day the judge of heaven and earth shall pronounce sentence upon that, and that shall be a just sentence. Those atrocities shall be visited. The indignation of the people against the Prince of Orange was great. They had put their trust in him, but they were put to shame in that trust. Many viewed this as treason toward the good cause. Ah, no doubt the prince had acted this way with good intentions. We already told you he wanted to spare the city of Antwerp against the vengeance of the governess. If the gates of Antwerp had not been closed, and the 10,000s of Calvinists had been able to hurry to the assistance of the beggars' army at Oosterweel, if Orange had placed himself at the head and had taken the leadership, he was a capable general. If the thousands from Zeeland had joined themselves to that, if, it did not happen. In God's counsel it was determined otherwise. God's ways are higher than our ways. Indeed, we cannot fathom God's ways. Yet everyone remains accountable for his deeds. But also here the golden thread of God's rule runs through everything. Strengthened by the victory at Oosterweel, the opposition was struck down everywhere by the soldiers of the governess. The persecution raged again in all its violence. The year 1566, which had commenced so hopefully, ended very darkly for the cause of God's church. Everything was knocked to pieces. The cooperation between the Roman Catholic and Protestant nobles no longer existed. And, in the meantime, Alva drew near. The everywhere dreaded Alva, who would execute the vengeance of the king. He approached with an army of upward of 10,000 men. His soldiers were the best trained in Europe. He would straighten things out in the Netherlands, and very good, too. The governess, who was not happy at all with the coming of the Iron Duke, wrote to her brother Philip II that it was no longer necessary for Alva to come. She had taken care that peace had been restored everywhere. It was of no avail. The dreaded Duke and his forces were already on the way. The Prince of Orange left the country and fled to his ancestral castle, the Dillenburg. He knew very well what was awaiting him. Alva had the death sentence of him and of several other prominent nobles in his pocket. The private secretary of King Philip had prepared 2 lists of those that were condemned to death. Alva received the one list, and the other he forwarded to William of Orange. Thus he knew exactly what awaited him. The name of Egmont was also upon that list. The prince warned him, but Egmont refused to flee. He answered the prince, "I have always served the king faithfully. Why then should I flee? I have done nothing unbecoming." And that was also true. Indeed, he had served the king faithfully. Too faithfully. The blood of many of God's children had been shed by him. Hence Egmont stayed. Yea, he even traveled a long distance to meet Alva and to welcome him. Alva received him very graciously. And later on, side by side, they rode through the gates of Brussels. But the Prince of Orange was wiser and departed before it was too late. But not only the prince fled, but also others did not wait for the coming of Alva. They feared the worst. By thousands and ten thousands they took to flight, and likewise left the country. The roads were filled with refugees, who took only several scanty possessions with them. Altogether more than 100,000 inhabitants left the country. Many fled to the German city of Emden, which for that reason was called the Ship of Christ. Many also sought an escape to other German cities. There were also others who crossed the North Sea and fled to England. And those that remained trembled. What would the future bring? On the 22nd of August, 1567, Alva and his excellent, well-provided-for army marched through the gates of Brussels. Shortly after that, the governess, Margaret of Parma, left the country. There was no longer room for her. Alva had come to take over her task. She was angry. She was offended. She received Alva very coldly in her palace, but it was of no avail. Even though she trembled with impotent rage, yet she went. Before we go any further, we shall briefly tell you something about William of Orange, who had already been mentioned more than once. He was the son of William the Rich and Juliana of Stolberg. The historians tell us that she was a God-fearing woman. William was born in 1533 in the castle of Dillenburg in Germany. William had four other brothers. We shall just mention their names: John, Louis, Henry, and Adolf. These are all well known from the Dutch history. William also had several sisters, because William the Rich and Juliana of Stolberg had a large family. When he was 11 years old, his cousin Rina de Calonne died. He had appointed William as his heir. The young William now received also the Principality of Orange, which is situated in the south of France. Since William would now become one of the richest and most influential nobles of the country, Charles V demanded that he should be brought up at the imperial court. Thus, at the age of 12 years, the young Prince of Orange departed for Brussels, where he received an excellent education. But it was an education which was strictly Roman Catholic. You may be sure that with fear and concern in her heart, his pious mother, Juliana of Stolberg, let him depart. He would go away from under her watchful eye, and the only thing which she still could do for her child was to pray. In Brussels, William accepted the Roman Catholic religion. He had to. He became a man of great consideration. He became the friend and confidant of Emperor Charles V. Because of his great wealth, he could live in luxury and excess. one feast followed upon another. During those years, he did not concern himself much about religion. Outwardly, he was a member of the Roman Catholic Church, but he lived very indifferently. He disliked the blood placards and hated the persecution. He abhorred the stakes. Why? Why must those that think otherwise be so horribly persecuted? He thought that it was terrible. Philip II, the son of Charles V, had an intense dislike toward William of Orange. He actually hated him, but he could not push him aside. Neither could he when his father abdicated the government and he had become King of Spain and Lord of the Netherlands. When Philip II departed for Spain, William of Orange became stadtholder of Holland, Zeeland, and Utrecht, while his influence in Antwerp was very great. Thus, with the other stadtholders, he would assist the governess in the governing of the country. And yet, the Lord had laid up a great task for this man. In God's time, he would hasten to the assistance of the oppressed and downtrodden people of the Netherlands. He would become the life and soul of resistance against Spain. In 1566, he left the Roman Catholic Church and became Lutheran. In 1573, he joined himself to the Calvinists. Finally, in 1584, he lost his life when he was fatally struck by the deadly lead of Balthasar Gerard. You can understand that we have mentioned very briefly something because there is much more to be told about that. He did not have an easy life. He had experienced many reverses and much grief during his life. But of him we may say, sanctified through suffering. He was feared and hated by his enemies. They have slandered and vilified him from all sides. Many times his friends did not understand him and suspected him. It is true, he also had his faults, but God wanted to use him as a founder of Netherlands liberty. He sacrificed everything for the cause of that oppressed people of the Netherlands, his property, his brothers, and his life. In the beginning, the struggle against powerful Spain seemed to be hopeless. When Haarlem fell and one of his friends wrote, "Perhaps you have made a league with a powerful monarch, otherwise you may as well give up the struggle." His answer was, "I have made a firm covenant with the potentate of all potentates." The word potentate signifies sovereign. Thus, he had made a covenant with the King of Kings. That gave him strength in the most difficult circumstances. That kept him standing when everything seemed to go in reverse. That gave him faith that God was able to turn all things for good. The band, Netherland Orange, has been laid by God himself. The Lord has often been pleased to use the House of Orange for the deliverance of that country and people, and as a blessing for his church. In that great wheel work of God, the House of Orange has also obtained a place. Even today, a descendant of that House of Orange reigns over the Netherlands. Let those people never despise or trample upon that House of Orange, because that is a gift of God. They should be thankful that they still have a dynasty. Neither should they ever revile that dynasty, but pray for it. That is the proper way. We shall say no more about this now. Yet I did want to say something about it because William of Orange and his descendants have occupied and still occupy such a large place in that country.